From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, money for Homeland Security is about to run dry, tied up in immigration reform politics.
I mean, I don't remember John Boehner having a conniption when George W. Bush used executive authority on immigration policy.
Plus, what's behind the cool reception Detroit's auto execs are giving to Elon Musk?
The problem that we have is that we have these entrenched incumbents that are used to change taking a long period of time.
And a rabbinical student uses the gay dating app Grindr to start building a spiritual community for gay Jews.
What's really special is that community building and the personal connection that comes from this.
And we talk about controlling deer in cities and suburbs. Those stories and much more today on Stateside. But first, the news. What can a city do about too many deer? Well, it depends on whom you ask.
Nobody ever agrees on deer management.
I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, controlling deer in cities and suburbs. But first, the clock is ticking. Funding for the Department of Homeland Security runs out Friday. That's if Congress can't figure out how to separate the DHS budget from the politics of immigration reform. House Republicans are using the Homeland Security funding bill to try to overturn President Obama's executive actions on immigration. And there aren't enough votes in the Senate to pass that House bill, so thus the stalemate. At the same time, members of Congress are trying to continue the business of Congress, looking out for their constituents. And one of them is Michigan Congressman Dan Kildee. He's here now with us from Washington. Welcome back, Congressman.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
We'll certainly dig into the Homeland Security budget issue in a bit, but I want to talk to you about something that you believe is going to help kids. What's the bill you plan to introduce today?
Today I'll introduce a bill that will extend support for after-school programs. It's the After School for America's Children Act, and it will invest in 21st century community learning centers all across the country, including in my hometown of Flint, Michigan, which is in many ways the birthplace of the notion that schools and after-school activity can actually help create more successful young people, and it actually helps their academic performance as well. And so this is an effort to continue this program, which could be under threat if, in fact, some legislation that's being considered is successful. We could see the Congress actually water down support for these programs.
How much are we looking at funding-wise?
It's $1.15 billion. For each of the next 5 years. And it goes a long way. It's money that is extremely well managed and well spent, because the cost of these after school programs per child based on what they actually deliver for these kids and meaningful activities is really modest. To me, this is one of those opportunities to invest in young folks whose futures are yet to be defined and give them a positive outlet for all their youthful energy, because the one thing we have learned is that when we don't offer positive opportunities for kids to expend their energy and explore their creativity, that they might find a negative outlet for that energy. And, you know, especially in communities that are financially stressed, have high unemployment, very few public services, and don't have community centers at every corner, or, you know, for kids whose families can't afford to have a Y membership, this is an opportunity for them to explore and to be creative and use their youthful energy in a positive way.
So they're doing activities, a whole array of things, health and physical fitness and art and music. So whether it's arts and crafts or dancing or whatever they may be doing, can you really imagine the GOP supporting something like this?
Well, you know, there has been bipartisan support for after-school programming. The difficulty is that what we're seeing is that some members of Congress, and unfortunately this is not one party or the other, conflate or somehow confuse the value of after-school programming with the desire to extend the school day. And what we're trying to make clear is that the kind of activities that are provided in after-school programming in the 21st century community learning centers is fundamentally different than simply adding another 60 minutes on the school day with the traditional curriculum. Getting away from the idea that the only way to grow the mind of a child is to continue to take classroom time and extend that, that's very important time. And I don't oppose extending the classroom time, the school day. But it's different. It's fundamentally different what a child gets from the after-school programming. It allows sort of the creative side of the brain to connect with the logical side of the brain. And the kind of learning that they experience in those after-school programs doesn't look like the traditional curriculum, but it really helps them when it comes to being able to focus in school and understand the connection between what they're learning and what they do in the everyday life.
So this bill that you're going to be introducing today is the After School for America's Children Act, for those who want to keep their eye on that issue. Now we have to turn to this funding showdown over the DHS budget. We'll take a listen here. In one corner, we have House Speaker John Boehner.
We're voting to block the president's overreach, his executive overreach, which I believe is beyond his constitutional duty and, frankly, violates the Constitution itself. This is not about actually the issue of immigration. What it is, it's about the president acting lawlessly.
And in the other corner, White House spokesman Josh Earnest, who says the administration supports the funding part of the House bill, but not the rest.
This is legislation that funds our efforts to protect our ports and our borders. It provides aviation security. It bolsters our cybersecurity. There's never a good time for Republicans to do something like this, but right now seems like a particularly bad time for them to do so.
Congressman Kildee, how do you see the stalemate playing out with the clock ticking to Friday?
Well, I think it's really important that the Republican leadership in both the House and the Senate listen to some of the advice that they've provided their own members and others in the past, and that is that you can't legislate through the appropriations process. They have majorities in both the House and the Senate. They can bring an immigration bill that defines immigration policy for the United States to the floor of the House tomorrow. And so for them to be taking the position that we're going to threaten to shut down important government functions in order to extract concessions from either the White House or from the Democrats in Congress on a policy question related to immigration, that is overreaching. That is overuse. So when Speaker Boehner uses, I think, intentionally incendiary language accusing the president of acting beyond his legal authority or, quote, lawlessly, first of all, that's not responsible for the speaker to say those things. He has a difference of opinion with the president over the decisions that he makes using his executive authority, but it's executive authority that the president possesses. I mean, I don't remember John Boehner having a conniption when George W. Bush used executive authority on immigration policy. So the speaker's position is that there should be no distinction, that the president has no authority to make a distinction between a convicted felon who may be undocumented and the parent of a U.S. citizen who may be undocumented. According to Speaker Boehner's policy, that parent of an American citizen who happens to be undocumented should be deported on the same schedule and as quickly and aggressively as a convicted felon. And all the president is saying is that when it comes to the people that we know are responsibly behaving, trying to get in line to become a part of the American experience, we should offer them that opportunity. And he's not going to back away from the executive authority that he possesses over some threat that the Republicans will use to try to shut down an essential function of government. He just shouldn't do it, and I support him.
And Congressman, we know that if this stalemate isn't worked out by the end of Friday, the funding does stop for Homeland Security. And we hear pretty consistently the public won't really notice the effects of that shutdown because most DHS workers would be deemed essential and they'd have to report to work. So you'd have 240,000 some TSA, Border Patrol and Secret Service workers forced to work without pay again after it having happened to them in the 2013 shutdown. Is this the kind of stuff we're going to be seeing, do you think, for the remainder of the Obama presidency with this cast of characters? Stalemate, vetoes, gridlock?
Yeah, I sure hope not. It's certainly no way to run the U.S. government or the greatest democracy, what we claim to be the greatest democracy on the planet. This is not putting our best foot forward. It certainly has consequences. And one of the things that I think many Republicans are saying is, oh, don't worry about it. These people will have to show up for work anyway. But the truth of the matter is, number one, that's not a responsible way to treat a professional public employee just for your own political gain. But secondly, there will be consequences. Firefighter grants through the Federal Emergency Management Agency, for example, will be suspended. So those communities that depend on services that are funded by the Homeland Security budget, it might not be the transportation TSA agent that loses, but it could be the local fire hall that no longer has the support that it once had because Congress has failed to act to fund this essential function of government. And again, this gets to that question. Congress has its job to do. The appropriations process is to fund these essential functions of government. We also have our lawmaking authority, and we could make immigration law. We should have comprehensive immigration reform. There's nothing preventing Speaker Boehner or Leader McConnell from bringing comprehensive immigration reform to Congress. But instead of doing that, they decide that, no, we're just going to try to, you know, extract concessions from the president on policy that he has authority over by threatening to shut down an essential function of government. Again, Speaker Boehner talks about the president overreaching. He's using the authority that he clearly has, but I think it's clearly an overreach for Congress, for the leadership in Congress, to threaten to shut down a portion of government because they themselves are unwilling to legislate policy and would rather threaten the president into doing what they want him to do rather than making policy themselves.
So we have these two views lined up looking across this no man's land. And for most Americans, I think people feel, boy, if we acted like this in our jobs, we would get fired. So
Right. What's
happening from where you're sitting in your seat in the House of Representatives, talking to the people around you? Is there something happening or can there be room for common ground?
I think right now, and I don't think this is good, but the Speaker seems to be waiting for what the Senate does. And this has been the pattern for Speaker Boehner to always sort of defer to the Senate on the really hard questions and then react later. It looks as though the Senate may take up separate bills. We'll see if that actually evolves. Leader McConnell intimated that they may do this. They may have already started the process. But to take up separate bills, a separate funding bill and separate legislation that would limit the president's authority for executive action, you know, both should stand on their own merit. And I don't think there's any problem with having a separate bill to come to the floor, and we'll vote yes or no on the question of policy. I hope that's what Leader McConnell does. If he does, the question then comes whether Speaker Boehner will take up that legislation or if he'll hold firm and basically force a shutdown.
Michigan Congressman Dan Kildee, thank you so much for speaking with us, and we'll all keep our eye on that deadline come Friday. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
All right.
You bet. Thank you.
Coming up.
People who are on Grindr are searching. They may be searching or looking for all kinds of different things, but one thing they are looking for is connection.
Finding God on Grindr? We'll hear more in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A recent community meeting in Ann Arbor illustrates a challenge many urban areas throughout Michigan are facing. Deer, specifically deer that are a road hazard, deer that are munching their way through gardens and parks and people's landscaping. Ann Arborites heard details of two ways to control the deer population, lethal and non-lethal. A biologist from Rochester Hills described his city's non-lethal program. They rely on better road signage, much more community education. And then a group called Washtenaw Citizens for Ecological Balance made their case for hiring sharpshooters. Sharpshooters that would take out 250 deer next winter, with more to be killed in subsequent years. Just what can a city do about too many deer? Kristen Bissell is with us now. She's a wildlife biologist with the Michigan DNR. Hello, Kristen. Welcome.
Hi, good to be with you.
Kristen, is there an objective way to determine whether a city has too many deer, or does it just come down to traffic accidents and complaints? I guess I'm asking, when is it time to take action?
It's really up to the community or the community's representatives to decide when they're at a point that they want to do something. Do we have a problem, and do we have a problem that we want to address? And then what's going to be the best way to address that for our community?
Are we seeing more deer statewide?
I wouldn't say that. I think maybe the issue is more that we're seeing more conflicts with deer in urban areas. Deer and human populations overlap everywhere, but in these urban areas, the conflicts seem to be a little bit less tolerable.
So as a biologist, I'm hoping you could help us look at these options, this lethal versus non-lethal. And we know that Ann Arbor Group, the Washtenaw Citizens for Ecological Balance, wanted these sharpshooters to cull 250 deer to get things started. How have you seen this work in other communities?
It's been the most commonly used method for managing deer populations in these kinds of communities. And we've seen success in it. You know, one thing that a community really should do is define what they believe success is. You know, a lot of people want to see more diverse vegetation growing in their parks so they can assess vegetation diversity with exclosures in those parks to see if lowering the deer density is actually decreasing the amount of browsing happening and increasing the structural and species diversity in parks. You might evaluate the number of complaints that are coming in about deer-related property damage or deer car accidents or all of those things. So those are some of the ways that you can evaluate success. And what we have seen for long-term programs, deer population is reduced. It takes, you know, effort to harvest a deer increases. The number of deer and the number of human-deer conflicts, I guess, decrease. The case that I have the most experience personally from my position is the Ella Sharp Park cull in Jackson, the city of Jackson, Summit Township. And when I first started, they went through all their public meetings. They'd been having public meetings for years, and they had finally come to a decision that they wanted to use lethal methods to address their problems. And so, you know, we worked together to do a permit that would allow them to remove deer out of season using sharpshooters. And their first year, it took about 3 days to shoot and harvest 80 deer. And then this year, it took over a month for them to get 30.
Mm.
So it's you see the difference in the densities, and you see the difference in the complaints. And you actually see the difference in, acceptance of a program, too. The first year of those programs are always very, very contentious. You usually see protesting, and you have a lot of very concerned calls, people worried about human safety. And that usually happens the first couple years of a program, but now I never really hear anything about it. It's just it happens every year. We manage deer here. This is a management program. This is how they handle it. And it's much quieter than it ever was before. So.
I'm speaking with wildlife biologist with the Michigan DNR, Kristen Bissell, as we look at ways that communities can deal with deer overpopulation. What about the non-lethal control methods? What kinds of things have you seen working in communities, Kristen?
You know, I know that Rochester Hills, I haven't dealt with them. I know that they moved to methods where they are reducing cover around roads and opening up roads a little bit to try to reduce car collisions with deer so that people have a better visibility of when deer are coming out. So there's things like that you can do. There's feeding bans that can happen. These things can reduce the number of negative interactions with deer, but they don't address population growth. So those communities still do have, increasing deer numbers. And so, again, it comes down to what does the community think the problem really is and what can they live with. I haven't dealt with a community that had enough of a problem to be working with me that didn't end up going in a route that would address population.
Hmm.
But, there's been talk of things like contraception and sterilization. Those are very, very intense methods. Those only affect birth rates, so they don't affect the lag time and seeing a population change. You still are waiting for animals to die and then not be replaced.
So you'd have to have some patience to have that pay off.
It would be very expensive, very elaborate. It would involve a lot of animal handling. Deer are not a species that handle as well as some other things. Some animals are you know, pretty easy to manipulate and release, and they get through it just fine. Deer definitely would have a mortality rate associated with handling. But that's something that right now we don't have a permit process. We don't have any contraceptives that are approved for Michigan, so it would be a process that's beyond my level. But if a community had a plan for going that route and wanted to bring it to us, we would certainly consider it. But as of right now, I'm always telling folks, you have to decide, you know, what the problem really is and have a method for assessing, you know, do you have a problem? What is your problem? And what is your definition of success?
And the only one that can really decide that is the community and the residents in, yeah. in meetings, such as the one that was in Ann Arbor, but it was pretty contentious. But
yeah. And it always will be. Nobody ever agrees on deer management. You know, even hunters is just one group of people that are interested in deer don't agree on deer management. So the interesting and good thing is that everybody values deer in some way, and we don't want people to lose that value for deer. We don't want them to become a species that is considered, you know, just giant rats in the streets. You're never going to eliminate deer. You will always have to be living with them. It's just a matter of, you know, how you want to live with them. Are you going to manage them or not? If you are going to manage populations, how are you going to do that? What method is right for you and your community? And, you know, do you have the resources to do it?
Kristen Bissell is a wildlife biologist with the Michigan DNR. Kristen, thanks so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
Oh, no problem. My pleasure.
Grindr is perhaps the best known of the location-based gay dating apps. Matt Green has discovered that Grindr is not only about looking for love or hookups. It can also be a place to find people who are searching for some sort of spiritual, even religious connection.
There is also a component that's very real of community organizing.
Matt Green comes from Ann Arbor. He's a second-year rabbinical student at New York City's Hebrew Union College, and he's become known as the Grindr Rabbi, using Grindr to reach out to gay Jews in New York City. Matt explains how GPS-enabled apps are changing the way people connect.
I mean, there's an idea that Grindr killed the gay bar, and the reason why is because gay men are on Grindr, finding each other on Grindr, and they don't need to go to a physical space to meet each other. And that reality, I think, is really important in terms of religious or cultural community organizing. That's a sort of principle that is real across the board, gay or straight or whatever, that people are using apps and are using technology to communicate in ways that are so far beyond the physical realm of what we were doing 30, 40 years ago.
So can you build spiritual ties through a dating app like Grindr? Matt takes us to the very beginning and explains how this idea came about.
Basically, I began rabbinical school last year in Israel, and when I came back from Israel, I downloaded Grindr and posted on my profile that I was becoming a rabbi. And so all of these people started reaching out to me about, what's that like? Can you be a gay rabbi? And then a million other questions after that, like, how do you keep kosher and so on? And basically, I had this idea that there had to be some way of bringing all of these people together. And essentially, that was the beginning of the project. My school at the beginning of this academic year mentioned that there was a program designed to inspire entrepreneurship and offer micro grants to pursue little projects. And I put the two together and I remembered this idea and the project was born.
And so I'm guessing there wasn't really any pushback from your teachers at Hebrew Union College. Was there any pushback when people began to realize kind of what the purpose of Grindr is?
Not really. I think that's been really interesting because I was pretty honest from the very start. I portrayed Grindr as the largest LGBT social network, which is true. And in addition to that, I fielded some questions about the sort of hookup nature of how Grindr is perceived. And people were a little bit skeptical, but in general, they were open-minded. I mean, the Reform Movement of Judaism, which Hebrew Union College is a part of, is the biggest movement of Judaism, but it's also the mainstream liberal movement of Judaism. So in general, gay rights is pretty important to the movement.
I'm interested in the kinds of questions and what you're getting from the people who are reaching out to you. I'm wondering, is it to reconnect with their spiritual roots? Is it to build a social Jewish community or all of the above?
I think on some level it is all of the above. I mean, I had a conversation with a conservative rabbi this weekend about it, actually. And he pointed out that people who are on Grindr are searching. They may be searching or looking for all kinds of different things. But one thing they are looking for is connection. And connection is assumed to mean a romantic or sexual connection. But realistically, it's also a communal or social connection. And so I think the spiritual piece is important, but it's also about using Grindr to create a community, to basically organize as a form of community organizing. I think more than anything else, it was a surprise because people started reaching out to me once I put it on my profile that I was in rabbinical school. People just opened up. And the funny thing, too, is people not only have a lot of questions, but I think have a lot of anger. They want to talk about their bad experiences with their childhood rabbis or with other rabbis they've had throughout their lives. And specifically in the gay community, that's a really interesting thing because even though I come from a mainstream movement that is incredibly progressive on gay rights, it's also true that organized religion in general is not exactly home or has not been home to the LGBT community. And I think specifically Judaism as well, Orthodox Judaism and more traditional strains of Judaism, regardless even of the posturing or the statements made by rabbis, it's still not always that welcoming. And so I guess I was tapping into this sort of sense of a desire to fit in. And I was really sort of moved by people's reaching out to me and people asking me questions.
So in a sense, what you're doing can be healing. You are doing a ministry.
In a sense, definitely. I mean, admittedly, it's kind of hard for me even now to say that I'm doing a ministry on Grindr. And also, it's important to note that I'm still only 2 years into my rabbinical training. And so the idea of me actually being a pastoral figure is still new. But yeah, actually, yes, I would say that there's certainly potential for some sort of ministry work on Grindr. And I think many of the conversations I've had and the connections I've made have been that. And also, that's an interesting segue into the potential for Grindr to be used by other pastoral figures. I mean, the community organizing piece and the one-on-one nature of the pastoral piece of Grindr actually do speak really promisingly to the goals and objectives of liberal religion.
And you've begun hosting Sabbath dinners, haven't you? And those Friday evening dinners are truly the heart of Jewish life, aren't they?
Yeah, so that's been actually really fun and I think really important to what I'm trying to do more broadly. Those dinners, just to give you an image, are a group of 10 or 12 people coming together, most of whom who don't know each other, because I've met virtually all of them on Grindr, and maybe they've talked to one another on Grindr or seen one another's profiles, but in all likelihood, they don't know each other. And they come to my house, and we say the blessings for the wine and the challah bread, and then we continue on with a really spiritually uplifting dinner of kosher food in which we're together as Jews talking about things that matter to us as Jews and as gay Jews, which is a really important void to fill.
Matt, how do you hope to grow this, we'll call it your Grindr ministry, this Grindr outreach?
Yeah, ministry is an interesting word. The word I use often is minyan, which is a casual word for Jews, technically a quorum of 10 religious Jews necessary for prayer, but a group of any Jews. So we call it the Grindr minyan. And basically, I'd really love to build an LGBT or queer community in Brooklyn of Jews, maybe around Shabbat services or maybe just Shabbat dinner, but in any case, Shabbat experiences in the neighborhood for this community. But then separate from that, what I really like to do outside of building this specific community is enable and empower people to replicate this idea elsewhere. I think it's really easy to do. Reaching out to people on Grindr, posting something on a profile about hosting a Shabbat dinner, and essentially doing the same thing in Michigan or in Seattle or wherever. Actually, a couple weeks ago, there was a dinner in L.A. A friend of mine hosted a similar dinner in Los Angeles, basically reaching out to people on Grindr, and it was also very effective. He had about 12 people show up, and it was exactly like what I described, the traditional blessings, the sorts of conversation about queer identity and Jewish identity. And I'd love to see that replicated all over the place.
Matt Green comes from Ann Arbor and East Lansing. He's a second-year rabbinical student at New York City's Hebrew Union College, and his nickname is the Grindr Rabbi, as he uses Grindr to reach out to Jews in New York and in Brooklyn. Matt, it was a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Still to come, we'll take a look at what's behind the cool reception Detroit's auto execs are giving to Elon Musk.
The problem that we have is that we have these entrenched incumbents that are used to change taking a long period of time.
That's coming up next. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As we talk about the auto industry, the Detroit Three, it's so easy to forget that these enormous companies began as scrappy little startups birthed by innovators who weren't afraid to set the status quo on its proverbial ear. An electrical engineer named Henry Ford was one such innovator. In 2015, a South African genius named Elon Musk is another. The co-founder and chief executive of Tesla Motors recently spoke to the Automotive World News Congress. It happened during the recent auto show in Detroit. And my next guest thinks the auto establishment did not give Musk the attention and respect he deserves. Kevin Kreese laid out his thoughts in a piece for Model D. Its title, Can Detroit Re-Revolutionize the Auto Industry, or is Elon Musk beating us to it? Welcome, Kevin.
Thanks for having me.
Before we dive into what Musk had to say when he spoke last month in Detroit, would you set the stage for us, as you do in your story, by reminding us of how Henry Ford was a disruptor?
Yeah, we love this word disruption now. And I think we sort of have these images of the West Coast, of Silicon Valley. HBO even made a show about, you know, disruption pretty much, right? Mm-hmm. That's really the roots of Detroit. And so we have this conversation often is what is sort of Detroit now? Do we want to become like Silicon Valley? No, we just need to sort of remind ourselves, look in the history books of what we were at the turn of the century. And we were this scrappy town that had a lot of money from sort of the lumber industry and whatnot. And we had young people that were playing with different ideas. And that's really what Henry Ford was. He was a young electrical engineer, and he had these wild ideas of sort of motorizing a bike, and he shared it with Thomas Edison at dinner one night.
And Edison said, do it.
Yeah, yeah, but it was this big dinner. You know, there's maybe 20 people at this dinner, and he was nervous, and he shared this idea. But fortunately, Edison really affirmed him and encouraged him to keep pursuing it.
Which he did, but as you point out so skillfully in your piece for Model D, he fell on his nose more than once before finally arriving at what has become the Ford Motor Company.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, a great piece of trivia is he actually founded what became Cadillac, which is obviously the luxury brand for General Motors, mm-hmm. a competitor to Ford. But
yeah,
that's a whole other story.
We digress. But he wasn't afraid to, one, be brash, and number two, fail on the way to what is ultimately success. And then we go to Elon Musk, born in South Africa, a Canadian-American entrepreneur, investor, and engineer. And he was wearing his hat as co-founder and chief executive of Tesla when he spoke in Detroit. And you and others call him the Henry Ford of our time. Why?
He's just a poignant leader right now. He's provocative. He's energetic. He says things that no one else is willing to say. He likes stirring the pot. He likes comparing himself to other prominent CEOs of past. Some see that as arrogant. other people see that as sort of exciting. And I think he has the brashness to think he can create whole new industries or revolutionize them, one being finance with PayPal, two being solar energy and really moving that industry forward, then taking an anemic NASA and really changing that whole – the story about what he's done there is incredible, really, and now with Tesla.
And what was his message? What did you hear him say that day?
Well, what's so exciting is when you start following the auto industry a little closer than the average person is that it's often just this dogfight over market share. You know, everyone's trying to get a quarter of a percent more of market share every year, or maybe a half a percent. But it's sort of these entrenched brands battling over market share. And then here you have Elon Musk. He stands up and he has no speech. He has no prepared notes. He stands up and he says, I'm here today to talk with you guys a little bit and help move the electric car industry forward. My whole goal, as stated in the beginning of Tesla, is not to dominate the world's auto industry, but to move the electric car industry forward because right now it's stalled. And then he sits down and we have this long-winded conversation, which is full of incredible details. And he talks for over an hour and he's very open about all these different things of the company that other CEOs are secretive. And that's sort of this culture that regionally we've developed is this secretive culture of not working together, siloed relationships, battling over market share. It's just not sort of an exciting, innovative, open, collaborative culture, it seems.
And how was he received, do you think?
Well, you know, Automotive News did a fantastic job with the event. The interview, I thought, was done really well. But when you looked around the room, it was mostly male, mostly older males of Caucasian ethnicity.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there was just a sense of grumpiness to it, you know, not an excitement, not sort of this energy of change that I think a younger generation of people like myself are excited by.
You use the word respect, that he didn't get the respect that you felt he deserved.
It's hard to put a finger on it, but Elon Musk was in town speaking. Like, this was a big deal. If Steve Jobs came to town to talk about this, we would be writing articles upon articles and going bananas over this. But we didn't do that with Elon. You know, there was intrigue. There were some articles written, mm-hmm. more than there would have been 6 months ago. You know, I don't think it's as big of a deal as it needs to be.
So based on what you saw that day at the Automotive World News Congress, do you think that young innovator Henry Ford, had he been speaking to that crowd, do you think he would have gotten the same response as Elon Musk got?
Oh, man. I mean, Henry Ford was very provocative. If you look into sort of his behavior, mm-hmm. his public statements, the way he worked with the press, he definitely loved the limelight. I mean, I think that's why there's a lot of similarities between him and Elon.
But that young innovator, that young electrical engineer got up there with his ideas.
Well, you know, when you have that frustration with a culture or a lack of reception, it only empowers you more to want to change it. And I think that's what differentiates someone who wants to be a manager of a company and someone who wants to really start a company to change things, is that that culture actually breeds a desire to disrupt it, which is why you're seeing these mobility companies really take off outside of the headquarters of transportation, mobility being Detroit, because they see that and they're so frustrated by the experience that we have when we try to buy a car, the current feature sets of cars, sort of the lack of change in a lot of ways, of the slowness to change in the automotive industry. I think so that's why you're seeing all these outside firms enter the space like Uber and whatnot. There is just a huge opportunity and they can't wait to disrupt it. I mean, Travis, the founder of Uber, he just salivates at disrupting the automotive industry. I mean, that's all he thinks about.
In the title for your story, Can Detroit Re-Revolutionize the Auto Industry, or is Elon Musk beating us to it? What do you mean by re-revolutionize?
Well, when you look at what was happening with the automotive industry at the turn of the century, you know, when all the car companies, everyone was starting to jockey for position, I mean, change happened relatively quickly in that period of time then. I mean, bikes didn't take off till the 1880s, which is mm-hmm. wild. Most people, I think, would assume that it was way before that. But bikes were just becoming hot. They were seen as a fad. People were starting to play with electrifying bikes. You know, the first car actually was created in Des Moines, Iowa, not in Detroit. Well, in how we understand the car, right?
Sure, sure.
And there was different reasons for how these industries took off. But really what happened is locally, investors decided they wanted to own this new nascent industry. And they poured money into it. And so we were able to lock down that early position. So right now we see this mobility space taking off. Owning a car, I would argue for the most part, not really enjoyable for the majority of people. They just don't really love it. If you have a lot of money and you can buy a luxury product then that's a different conversation. But that's not the masses. And so since we have this unenjoyable experience, this whole new world of solutions are coming into the fold to get rid of car ownership. And that's the opportunity we have to move from a single car ownership sort of concept of mobility to really a multimodal network of sort of on-demand service of different forms, from using bike sharing to car sharing to car rental, all these things coming together. And so that's sort of what we mean by re-revolutionizing.
Getting back to what you heard Elon Musk talk about in his push for electric vehicles, and I'm going to open up and share my technology, let's move this forward. Might we also note that for the auto industry, it has been a bumpy ride as they've tried to roll out their EVs. And certainly the government, the Obama administration, predicted 1 million EVs would be on our highways by this year. And we've got, what, something around 30,000. So can you force the public to take something that is seems to be, except for some exceptions, pretty lukewarm about?
Well, this revolution and this re-revolution of mobility is really, there's so many different parts of the conversation. Electric vehicles are one. But in my opinion, really this larger conversation about mobility is the more interesting one. You have Uber. Uber's not using electric cars. Well, you know, some Ubers are, but it's not – what's driving that change is not electric cars. It's this getting rid of car ownership and moving towards, you know, a subscription model. Imagine just signing up and you just get unlimited use of a car service for a month. These are the things that are changing. And you can use, you know, internal combustion engines there. We don't need these new technologies. But those new technologies, when they all come together, that's where we see this huge revolution. That's where we see the cost of maintaining a car and using a car plummets when you have an electric car. So these costs start to come down. These network effects of using iPhones, these models of getting rid of ownership, all these things are swelling together to create this huge tidal wave.
What do you think is the price that the auto industry, I'll use all in capital letters, the folks that you saw kind of with their arms crossed, kind of regarding Elon Musk and his ideas with, we'll say, not so enthusiastic and quite skeptical. What price do you think they could pay for that?
Oh, my goodness. It's monumental. And this is, I think, the sort of fear that is a very real possibility in the relative near future, because the problem that we have is that we have these entrenched incumbents that are used to change taking a long period of time. You know, ABS braking, I don't know, took 30 years or something like that to fully roll out to all cars. So we think that this is how long change takes. But we are not understanding that change is now exponential with networks and the internet and how the internet speeds communication and all these different things. So adoption is going to shift rapidly. And so right now, a big point that the automotive space uses to talk about this, how this change is not to be feared, relatively speaking, we have a long runway because it's going to take a long time. For this morning, quote, at 230 million used cars on the road in the world, it's going to take a long time to change that. But what that doesn't understand is it's not taking into account that what happens if we really start deciding just stop owning cars. Look at the growth of Uber. It's incredible the markets they're reaching. I mean, they're moving into rural markets now. You have the great, you know, critic who says, oh, what about the rural town? That doesn't matter. Like, they are moving into those markets. And there's a reason that they're valued at 2/3 of, you know, the market cap of Ford. Like, this isn't a surprise. These changes are happening. And the fallout for Detroit, when you talk about the impact, is immense, because we think it's bad when the inner city has blight and abandoned homes of job loss. But, you know, when you look at the metrics over the years, we just didn't really have any growth over 50 years. Pretty much people just moved to the suburbs and they abandoned the core. Well, what were all the people in the suburbs doing for jobs? They're working for the automotive industry. And when you get rid of this car ownership model, guess what? You only need a fraction of the cars to meet peak demand in these subscription model services. In fact, a study was done on Ann Arbor. When you look at the total amount of trips taken by all car drivers in Ann Arbor, they found that they could meet the peak demand of all the trips. Everyone could be happy in this sort of future model of subscription with only 15% of the cars currently used. An 85% decline in units? Oh my gosh, we should be freaking out about that.
Kevin, what kind of conversations do you hope that your piece in Model D will prompt?
What got me excited about this is the collision of all these different trends coming together. And then I grew up in this city that is dominated by the auto industry. And we talk about revitalization of the city and the state. But we're forgetting, how do we actually revitalize in terms of creating jobs and an economy? What are the growth areas? And we see the automotive as this older area that we actually are insecure about. We're actually ashamed that we depended on – we're a one-horse economy, and we hate that. But we're not realizing that that one-horse economy is completely changing right now and provides a lot of new opportunities to build whole new companies off of. And so – my hope really with the piece is to talk about this new economy that's growing, that's forming, the inherent advantages we have locally, and to really get everyone together to start getting excited about this.
Writer Kevin Kreese. His piece on Elon Musk can be found at modeldmedia.com. Kevin, always great to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone who enjoys a good Michigan wine should raise a glass in tribute to Len Olson. Without Len Olson, Michigan might well not have its 107 fully operating wineries with its 15,000 acres of grapes every year. This pioneer of Michigan's wine industry died late last year. Chris Cook is our Detroit Magazine's chief wine and restaurant critic. Chris, tell us about Len Olson and his ties to Michigan.
In 1970, he founded Tabor Hill Winery in Buchanan, which actually was the first winery post-Prohibition to be licensed in Michigan. Now, there were others around there, but what's significant about Len is that in the 1960s, he started moving away from the grapes that were here, which were the French hybrids and the North American grapes, and into the vinifera grapes. Now, the vinifera grapes are all the ones we know, like Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, Riesling, all the standard grapes we know today. The issue at that time was that nobody believed that you could grow those kind of grapes in Michigan because of the wonderful weather that we are enjoying these days here.
So there was like, you can't have a Michigan winter when, and these grapes, they don't go hand in hand. Huh?
Well, they didn't think they could survive.
Yeah.
And first of all, they said you'll never get the ripening time. There's not enough time of good sunshine days in Michigan weather to ripen. And Olson proved them wrong. And he planted Chardonnay and he planted Riesling and he made a wine from them. Now, they weren't at first tremendous wines that we have today. But what that did is it opened to the door to the non-believers. And I think, I don't mean to diss MSU on this, Michigan State University, but they at that time didn't believe that this could be done. But once they saw that Olson did it, they then started doing all the trial research and agricultural stuff and got behind the industry on it. And it moved from there. You know, in 1969, 1970, when Olson was doing this, Leelanau had a couple of guys that were growing little plots of grape, but they had no wineries up there. And today, as we know, Leelanau is sort of the big monster of Michigan wine. So Olson really gets a lot of credit for that.
What do you think it was that made him say, I'm going to try this?
Olson was one of those visionaries that come along every once in a while. And like a lot of visionaries, he had the drive, he had the belief, and he had the idea. And so he could take it that far. But then, for instance, his own winery wasn't financially successful. Mm-hmm. And he wound up selling it to the Upton family of Whirlpool fame, who still own it today. And he eventually moved out of Michigan, and he was gone. He was gone for, I think, 20-some years and moved to Kentucky and went into a combination of beer and wine business. And then, lo and behold, in 2009, Len Olson reappears in Southwest Michigan. And he founded something called Baroda Founders Winery and was there until he died in December. But he returned to where he started a lot of things. And there's a sort of a poetic thing swing to his life.
You have to wonder, what would be the perfect glass of Michigan wine with which to toast the life of Len Olson?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I would say it'd have to be a Riesling because he made so many good ones. And, boy, you got me stumped there. I'm going to get in trouble if I say that. But I will say Riesling or Chardonnay without question.
There you go. Chris, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Chris Cook is chief wine and restaurant critic for Our Detroit Magazine.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Mercedes Mejia, Annie Norris, Ari Sandberg, Lindsay Scullin, and Katrina Schaefer. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Candy. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.